Great to be with you today. Appreciate the opportunity this morning to be your speaker. As Brett mentioned, it's great to see some faces that we haven't seen in a while. It's nice to have you with us, despite the fact that it's some sad news that brought many of you back home. That doesn't diminish the gladness that we have to be able to see you today. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Peace I leave you, my peace I give you. The law of sowing and reaping is dependable. It's an undeniable truth. In our relationships, when we sow seeds of the Spirit, by God's Spirit and grace and power, we reap fruit of the Spirit. And one of those fruits is peace. It's a blessing of fruit that materializes most profoundly in relationships. But for the Spirit to operate in our lives, to be able to see the fruit of peace, I believe we have to sow seeds of peace. I want to talk to you about some relationships today, and in particular, broken ones. Air traffic control conversations are recorded. That can be good or bad. There's a website that actually has a collection of some conversations that have happened between air traffic control and pilots. Most of them are pretty mundane, but every so often there's one that's kind of interesting. Some years ago, a U.S. air jet landed in Fort Lauderdale and made a wrong turn, and it came nose to nose with the United Airlines jet. On the tape, you can hear an air traffic controller go ballistic. You can hear an irate female voice scream, "U.S. Air 2771, where are you going? I told you turn right on Charlie. You turned right on Delta. Where are you going? Stop right there. I know it must be difficult to tell the difference between a C and a D, but get it right." She continues on. "You've messed everything up. It'll take forever to sort all of this out. You stay right there and you don't move until I tell you to move. You can expect progressive taxi instructions in about a half an hour. I want you to go exactly where I tell you, when I tell you, how I tell you. You got that, U.S. Air 2771? Dead silence. A couple of seconds later, you can hear a male voice on the tape say, "Wasn't I married to you once?" Seems it's more difficult, perhaps these days, to get along with people that we think are difficult. Over the last couple of years, we've suffered some huge losses. I would expect you would agree that some of the most painful losses that we've experienced or witnessed involve relationships. Perhaps you've seen it with friends or your own family even. Some of the actual physical losses that we've had, of course, through death. Some have passed because of the COVID virus. But often, many times, it's a different kind of loss. Something like, "Well, in the last 18 months, I've lost my best friend fussing about politics." Or, "I lost my marriage." Or, "I've lost a relationship with my children." Or someone close in my family arguing about something. It's hard to be happy when our core relationships are not healthy. In many cases, the breach should ask us or prompt us to ask, is it really worth it? And so, as we prepare to begin a new year in just a few weeks, which is hard to believe, maybe it's time for a reset. Perhaps it's time to remind ourselves of how much God values solid, loving, generous relationships. Maybe it's time to reconsider the value of peace. Maybe it's time to intentionally sow seeds of peace. Let's dive into what God tells us in Romans, the 12th chapter, starting in verse 14. Blessed are those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no evil for evil. Have regard for the good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, and as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I want to read it again, this time from the Great Book Translation. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not condemn. Be happy with those who are happy. Cry with those who are crying. Get along with one another. Mix with humble people. Don't try to be clever. Don't think you are wise. If someone does wrong to you, don't pay him back with another wrong. Be sure you do what everyone already knows is right. If possible, for your part, live in peace with everybody. Don't avenge yourselves, dear friends. Instead, leave room for God to punish. For it is written, the Lord says, revenge belongs to me. I will pay it back. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. By doing this, you will make him burn up with shame. Don't let evil defeat you. Instead, use good to defeat evil. First thing this text makes clear to us that as a Christian, you're going to have some relational conflict. Being a Christian does not mean a relationship suddenly just got easy. In fact, our faith will undoubtedly take us into some choppy relational waters. You're going to have conflict even with brothers and sisters. In fact, and sadly, as we've seen, some of the most brutal conflicts are seen between Christians. The surprise is not that Christians have relational conflict. The surprise to the world, and sometimes even to us, should be the way that Christians respond to relational conflict. Christians should aggressively wage peace. The goal is more than just offering forgiveness. The goal should be pursuing reconciliation, repairing the relationship. Let me be clear on what I'm not saying. Sometimes reconciliation is not wise. And I'm talking about it where things like abuse are involved, where there's been verbal or emotional or physical or sexual abuse. I'm not saying that we should just get over it and get back into a relationship where more abuse can take place. In those situations, help and perhaps even protection is needed. But let's be honest. Most of the time, when there is a relational breach and there is no reconciliation, it's not because reconciliation is unwise. It's because it's uncomfortable. And Christians should never passively accept cold war. Well, you just stay over there and I'll stay over here. We'll just promise not to shoot at each other. That's not good enough. Paul says, as far as it depends on you. Jesus' directive is simple. Go. Be a peacemaker. Sow seeds of peace. That's a benefit in the spiritual realm, no doubt, but it's also really good advice. In business, for example, pursuing reconciliation always pays dividends. The times that I've failed to pursue it, maybe they weren't a disaster, but I had regret, knowing that I likely could have changed a situation from just tolerable to terrific. Following Jesus' command to go the extra mile means that we need to plan on doing some traveling. So here's a big takeaway. Followers of Jesus go far to live in peace with others. The emphasis of this text is not waiting for the other party to do the right thing or to make things right and then respond appropriately. The emphasis is on making the intentional move in the direction of the other person. Look again at verse 18. Do all you can to live in peace with everyone. Do all you can to keep the drawbridge down. And as Christians, we've got some really strong motivation to move in the direction of someone where there's a broken relationship, and it might not even be our fault. You say, why? Why on earth would I do that? Why, if the relationship is broken and it wasn't my fault, why should I care about it? Why should I move in that direction? Simple. Because that's what God did for you. And me. Remember, we broke the relationship. We turned our back on God. And yet, God pursued us. It's the big message of the gospel. When we didn't deserve it, when we disturbed the peace, when we broke the relationship, God still came after us. When we pursue peace, we put the gospel on display. By the way, we should work to make repentance and reconciliation for the other person as easy as possible, not more difficult. We should never have the idea that we need to make the other person pay for what they did. That's not picking up your cross. That's hitting somebody with it. When we lower the drawbridge, we should do all we can to pave the way. Here's the thing. The initial work, the heavy lifting of reconciliation, always, always, always falls to the strong one, not the weak one. That's taking the first step. That's pursuing with humility. That's bearing the burden. That's taking up your cross. That's paying the price. And it requires courage and strength of God. Exhibit A was Jesus winning our victory on the cross. So as you think about some changes, some ways to grow during the next year or the next week or this afternoon, perhaps God is calling you to take a step toward peace. The Hebrew writer said, pursue peace with all people. Another translation says, make every effort. Hebrews 12 and 14. And it is work. It's hard work. But it's work that must be pursued in the spirit of Christ. And so let me suggest maybe three short prayers that you could offer that would help keep us focused, but also invite God and His hand in our peace mission. Here's prayer number one. Help me see the log in the fog. Let's be honest. Pretty rare that a conflict exists and it's the total fault of one person. Maybe it's even mainly one person's fault, but it's pretty rare that conflict is just one person's fault, period. Sowing seeds of peace means acknowledging the great likelihood that some part of the tension is something I need to own. And that's hard for me. Here's why. Because I'm right most of the time. At least I think I am. And I guarantee you, if there's a break in the relationship, I think I'm right. Sound familiar? Isn't it interesting that right after Paul said, live in harmony with one another, he said, don't be proud. You can't end hostility without humility. And we're all more self-righteous than we think we are. Self-righteousness clouds our vision. It adds fog to the situation. It's amazing how much clarity that we can have at seeing the other person's wrong, and how much fog there seems to be for me to see my own. That's why Jesus said, why are you worried about the speck of sawdust that's in the other guy's eye? When you got a log in your own, that's the first thing we pray is, God, help me see the log in the fog. So a woman writes into Reader's Digest about a conversation she had had with her mother, who many years ago had been hurt terribly when she was abandoned by her husband. She had never pursued remarriage. So this grown woman was asking her mom, why have you never thought about getting married again? The older lady replied, because men just come with so much heavy baggage. I just don't need all that baggage in my life. The daughter took the mother's hand and said, Mom, I hate to break it to you, but you're not exactly carry-on luggage yourself. Each first day of the week, when we assemble, we observe the Lord's Supper. And when we do, one of the benefits is a stark reminder. We're not exactly carry-on luggage. We all have some baggage. We all need grace. And there are times that we need to pray, God, is there something about me that's an obstacle to us? Let me say that again. Is there something about me that's an obstacle to us? Proverbs says, fools make fun of guilt, but the godly acknowledge it and seek reconciliation. Fools say, not my problem, not my concern. Godly people own their wrong and they try to make it right. And so we've got to be humble enough to do that, to acknowledge what we need to own, even if what you need to own is truly a speck compared to what somebody else needs to own. And just say, I'm sorry. Not, I'm sorry, but, or, I'm sorry you feel that way. It's not apologizing. It's justifying. We just need to say, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? We gotta have faith in how powerful that is. Not just in moving the relationship along, but keeping us right with the Lord. And let's not wait to do it until we feel like it. That's the second. Help me see the log in the fog. Give me a heart to start. Notice, everything that Paul says here suggests that it's not wise to wait for the other person to approach you. In fact, it's just the opposite. This is not a text about how you act when the other person makes the first move. This is a text about you making the first move, even if you're not the one who created the mess. Again, recall what Jesus did. He did not make a mess of things, yet he took the first step to clean it up. Look at the verbs again. Bless those, do what is right, overcome evil with good. The call is not to be a peace lover. It is to be a proactive peacemaker. Jesus did not say, hey, y'all get your act together and then I'll come for you. Understanding, as we should, that dying for us was essential to enable us to get our act together. It takes more than deciding what you're not going to do to make it worse. It takes deciding, what can I do to make it better? And that leads to one of the most radical things that Jesus ever taught. We read it so fast, a lot of times I don't think we think it like all the way through. It's a Sermon on the Mount, of course, Matthew chapter 5. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. There are a couple of aspects of this statement I think are easy to miss. The first is this. We tend to consider how we feel about somebody else. In other words, do I have something against somebody else? And if so, well, it's naturally inferred that a follower of Jesus has the obligation to prioritize confronting and apologizing with the aim of reconciliation. That's kind of a given. But Jesus actually takes it a step beyond that. He says, if you think that somebody has something against you, go and work on it. Let's face it. We know that somebody's upset with us. So even then, Jesus says, go work on it. Then come worship. In any instance, Jesus is saying, my followers are always the ones to initiate reconciliation, even before they attempt to worship me. But there's more. In those days, you didn't get the car and drive 10 minutes across the Metroplex to go to church. You couldn't just step outside the church building and ring somebody up on the phone and say, I'm sorry. Many times you walked hours or even days to the village to get to the temple. So we have to understand how stunningly inconvenient what Jesus was saying actually was. Wait, it took me almost 3 days to get here. You're saying that I leave my gift, walk back 3 days, make it right, and then come back? What? Besides that, not only is it inconvenient, isn't that irreverent? Isn't God supposed to be first? Aren't we supposed to love God first and foremost? Are you telling me I should love people more than I love God? Here's what Jesus is saying. You can't be close to God when you're intentionally choosing to be unreconciled with somebody that God loves as much as he loves you. A father doesn't want gifts from kids who aren't talking to each other. Some of you, like us, are empty nesters. Can you imagine getting a call from one of your kids saying, well, I want to bring you a birthday gift, but not while my brother and sister are there. I don't want to see them. I mean, I want to bring you something, but what father would be honored by that? In fact, the gift you really want is for them to be reconciled. Don't wait. Initiate. Oh, in 3 days? Jesus could have lovingly but firmly replied, yeah, I know something about working on something for 3 days, something big. When I was a kid, I really disliked history. I thought it was dull and boring. And as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate it more. Partly because I think as you get older, you start to realize that you yourself are going to soon be history. But one of the places I enjoy visiting is Washington, D.C., and I'm always inspired by the monuments. And so if I'm there and I have an opportunity, I kind of try to sneak away and go see a few of them. My favorite is the Lincoln Memorial. And it's especially cool at night. And so if you get the chance, I really urge you, take a nighttime walk of the memorials, and particularly the Lincoln Memorial. On the walls of that memorial inside it are engraved two of the greatest speeches probably ever given by an American president: Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural. In Lincoln's Second Inaugural, he knew the Civil War was almost over. He intentionally speaks to the importance of peace and reconciliation. He says, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work that we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." Soon Lincoln would have the chance to sort of practice what he was preaching. I'm told that the day that the word came that the war was indeed over, there was a celebration on the lawn of the White House. Lincoln came out to give some remarks. At the end of the speech, he turned to the band and said, "Now I want you to play a song for me." So they got ready to play the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It was the theme song for the Union Army. Lincoln shocked everyone and said, "I want you to play Dixie." Now, he was not saying both sides are equally at fault, the position of slavery was clearly wrong. What he was saying was, if we're going to heal a divided nation, we're both going to have to start moving. And I'm ready to signal a start. Today, we live in a time where tensions are high. While not equal to the time of the Civil War, we don't have to look very far to see conflict, do we? Rather than just grumble about it, let's see the opportunity that that creates for those of us who represent the Prince of Peace. In a world that's full of conflict, Jesus is sending his disciples as his Peace Corps. We are to attack other people with good. And to do that doesn't just require divine power. It requires divine wisdom. So after we've prayed, "Show me the log in the fog and help me have a heart to start," let's consider, "Show me how to bless this mess." Following Jesus is more than just disdaining badness. It's dispensing goodness. And one thing Christians never do is succumb to the two wrongs make a right kind of thinking. "I didn't start it. I don't care. But they just keep..." "I don't care. They don't deserve to be..." "I don't care." Judgment and punishment is God's job. Let him do it. We never think two wrongs will make it right. We think respond to a wrong with a right. And the reason we think this is because Jesus did. And that's what he taught us to do the same. Luke chapter 6. I apologize for how small the print is. "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Praise for those who spitefully use you. To him who strikes you on one cheek, offer the other also. To him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back. And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise. But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. We tend to think about this context, this concept in the extreme. Not often I get slapped. I suppose that's the same for you too. It's not unusual, not as dramatic, but it's usually just a snide remark or a perceived offense. And I have a decision to make. Am I going to respond as a grown-up or a child? Am I going to talk back and stomp off? Or do what Jesus says? It means we're going to have to pay some bills we didn't rack up. Is Jesus saying just be a wimp and a doormat? No. He's not condoning passivity. He is condoning courageous activity. You know how strong and brave you have to be to receive something that is ugly or evil or unkind and intentionally choose to respond with goodness? He's calling us to live in the spirit of Christ, to act on the conviction that evil is no match for good. That when you return good for evil, you're not just being Christ-like, you're being smart. It's the most effective way to respond. In fact, to be unsure of the power of good is to be unsure of the power of God. I want to repeat that. When we are unsure of the power of good, we're saying that we're unsure about the power of God. Jesus' whole life was built on this conviction that good is not just better, it's greater than evil. It's why he went to the cross, and on a cross, he was willing to literally absorb evil, and he deliberately dispensed good by dispensing grace. We've got to be careful. Here's the unfortunate truth for many of us. We love the idea of receiving unmerited favor. We tend to dispense favor based on merit. So perhaps you could sum up the whole text of Romans 12 with one phrase: take up your cross. When the peace has been disturbed and somebody you thought once was close is now estranged, take up your cross. What does that look like? Well, there's some pretty good suggestions in this text. When we're speaking with God, we might ask him for words that would build up the other person. They weren't expecting a blessing, but you gave them one. Ask God what to say. Maybe you could ask God for wisdom on ways you could celebrate with them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. I'm not saying we condone sin. I'm saying that almost every person has something going on in their life that you could celebrate or praise. Maybe you could ask God for insight on how you could mourn with them, because most people, and you know this, most people, when they are unkind or mean or ugly, they're acting out of a wound that we may not know anything about. So maybe you could just mourn with those who mourn. Or you could ask God to reveal the needs that you could meet. Paul said, if they're hungry, give them something to eat. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. Ask God for a simple way that you could just unexpectedly show kindness. Because here's the thing. Spitefulness may break the spirit, but only kindness will break the heart. So I want to challenge us at a time when the world so desperately needs the witness of Jesus following peacemakers, let's courageously let down the drawbridge instead of keeping it up. Reminds me of a story from a few years ago. I just heard this told recently, and I don't know if it still exists. I don't honestly know how true it is. But for years, there were two fences that ran parallel in the farmland of Alberta. Over half a mile, side by side, 2 feet apart. Here's the story. The land was owned by two guys, Paul and Oscar, two farmers. Paul went to Oscar one day and he said, I want to run some cattle on my land, so let's go in together and let's build a fence. Oscar said, why on earth would I help you build a fence that I don't need? You build it. So Paul did. Oscar saw him one day and said, hey, I see we have a fence now. Paul said, what do you mean we have a fence? I had my land surveyed. I built my fence 2 feet inside my land. So if you ever run livestock on your land, it gets up close to my fence. They're on my land, and I'm going to shoot them. Later, Oscar did, in fact, decide he wanted to run some livestock. So he had to pay to build a fence half a mile long, 2 feet from the other guys. These two guys die, never reconciling. Now, what do you think the legacy is of that? What's the reputation of those men in that community? Two old stubborn codgers who left a legacy of foolishness. Over what? None of us want petty foolishness to be our legacy. You and I don't want to be remembered at how well we practice Cold War. So let's sow seeds of peace. Even if it doesn't bless the other person, there's some pretty good reasons to do it. It'll honor God, and it'll bless us. Here's why. Reconciliation is a two-way street. I can forgive you, but I can't make you want to reconcile. True. But let's not make that a reason or an excuse not to start. Paul says, I can do what I can do, but I need to do it. As far as it depends on me, the goal is knowing you did everything that you could do. You may not achieve reconciliation, but you can relieve some regret. You see, when you go far to live in peace with others, you can live at peace with God and yourself. You can know, as far as it depended on me, I sought peace. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. He never promised that we would have any peace on the outside. In fact, just the opposite. He says, in the world, you're going to have trouble. He never promised peace on the outside. But he promised, if you obey the teaching of the Spirit, you will live with peace on the inside. In fact, the blessing that Jesus offers isn't necessarily happiness, something better, joy. Having the blessing of peace on the inside is a great way to live, and it's a great way to be remembered. George H.W. Bush was well known as a skilled and prolific letter writer. In fact, I've got a book of his letters. It's fascinating to sort of read history that way. One of his more famous letters is the one that he wrote on his last day in the White House before he was replaced by Bill Clinton. You can see a copy of this dated January 1993. George Bush had lost an election. He was feeling deeply rejected. He was a one-term president, not something a president wants as a descriptor. Nevertheless, his last act as president was to leave a note for his successor in the Oval Office. He said, "Dear Bill, when I walked into this office just now, I felt the same sense of wonder and respect I had 4 years ago. I know that you will feel that too. I wish you great happiness here. I never felt the loneliness some presidents have described. There will be tough times, made even more difficult by criticism that you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. You will be our president when you read this note. I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success now is our country's success. I am rooting hard for you. Good luck, George." I'd like to believe that when he left the Oval Office for the last time, he was at least taking the initial steps toward peace on the inside. In fact, we know now that he went on to become a father figure of sorts to Bill Clinton, something that Mr. Clinton didn't have as a boy. That's a legacy worth leaving. How about you? Are you willing to take up your cross? Are you willing to respond to Jesus' command to stand with the peacemakers, to sow seeds of peace? The first step, of course, is to seek peace with God. And he offers that through the gospel. We give you the opportunity to respond to it today as we stand and sing the song of Solomon.